Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5 color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com, DR5. For the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out, www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output. But they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks, the community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it, they have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. On today's Inside Analog Photography Radio Program, we're going to have with us Chris Usher. Chris is a professional photojournalist, travels worldwide shooting for an array of magazines, People, you name it, all kinds of great stuff. Also, Chris is an avid user of analog photography. He has a bunch of 4x5 handheld converted Polaroids. He shoots instant film. He shoots a lot of 4x5. He does a lot of great work. He did a really cool book in regards to Katrina. A lot of neat stuff that Chris has been doing. And, of course, shooting lots and lots of large format, handheld analog photography. Chris, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, great.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Chris, you're a great photojournalist, a great photographer, an all-around cool guy. And I want to talk to you today about Chris and how you got into photography and what sort of got you into shooting all this great work. And I think one of the things that we want to talk about today is your continued use of analog photography in this digital environment that you're in. So I guess to start with here, how did you get involved in photography to start with?
Well, first of all, Scott, thanks for the kind words on your intro there. Being a great photographer, I'm sure that's kind of debatable sometimes. But yeah, I got into photography some time ago when I was a kid. I really enjoyed it. I think that an interesting point in this day and age is that pretty much everyone that's coming up now is all digital or mostly digital. And I think the thing that really roped me in, and I think the thing that roped almost every photographer in up to the digital age, was the magic that happens in the darkroom. Going out, shooting film, and seeing that print come up in the tray was pretty much the hook, so to speak, that got me involved. So I learned to develop black and white film, got some books out of the library, and stuffed towels under the door in my bathroom at home when I was like 12 or so. I got to a point, I shot for the school yearbook, and then it lay dormant for a number of years until my senior year in college, when I'd gone through a whole lot of ideas of business major and accounting major and all this stuff that really didn't ring true with my heart. And at heart, I am an artist, and I always wanted to be, but I was never any good with a pen or a brush, so photography was the logical next place to go. I ended up getting into the journalism sequence at Indiana University, graduated from there, and went to newspapers, went from newspapers to freelance back in 1990. I've been freelance ever since, working for all the usual suspects that you find on your newsstand today. In fact, I just got done doing an assignment for People magazine. Just got back yesterday, so that's pretty much it, in a nutshell.
Do you dig the freelance stuff compared to working for like a regular paper gig?
Well, I'll say I really love that because I could accept or deny assignments piecemeal and be in control of my life. The back shot of that is that you're always worried that there's not going to be another job coming down the pipe. You don't have that security of a regular payment, and certainly you have to pay your own health care and all of those kinds of things. Ultimately, I think any kind of photography, if you ask most any photographer, I think it's a great profession because you get to do what you love to do, and you get paid to do it. So, but with freelance, like I say, and there's always that worry that you might not have another job, but it just keeps going, and it has now for 20 years for me. But I will admit that editorial photography, and particularly freelance, is definitely on the wane due to all kinds of things in the marketplace. The paradigm has most definitely shifted, and it's not as lucrative or as guaranteed as it once was back in the better days, in the heydays of photojournalism. So I do now do more gallery printing and fine artwork as well to augment that.
Do you find that you like doing that better, or are you like more being sort of on the run, just going to a gig that's sort of spontaneous compared to ones that maybe that are set up and planned?
Well, I'll tell you, one thing that I enjoy probably the most, I'm a huge disciple of Henri Cartier-Bresson and the whole make art out of the world at large without any manipulation. That's what journalism is that you are documenting the world in a way that is visually interesting. And I find that a real, almost a hunter-quarry kind of satisfaction that I get from that, rather than something where I'm going to go out with my large format camera and find a beautiful pastoral scene, set it up and make the movements and on a tripod and wait for the light to be just right and just shoot it. Journalism is great. Plus, it was definitely a much more guaranteed income source. But ultimately, I love being an artist first. I don't really necessarily set things up like you do for commercial work, which I also do, where you have to create basically a scene or something for a company. You have to do that, but in journalism, that's obviously very taboo, and I don't do that kind of work with journalism. I find the greatest satisfaction about journalism is that you have cause and reason to be at the forefront of what is important today, and you're documenting it, and therefore you get this front row seat to history, if you will. Particularly, I spent 10 years covering the White House for Newsweek, U.S. News, and Time magazine, and I don't really do that anymore. I'm still kind of a bullpen pitcher. They call me in now and again, but moved along to other things.
So, Chris, you're, of course, doing all these great editorial assignments for People magazine and newspapers and all kinds of wire services, and, of course, being at the White House for years. But I think you're one of the last guys around that are actually truly still using analog capture in his workflow, in his work in all.
Well, I desperately hope that I'm not the last guy doing it. And in fact, I know I'm not. I mean, certainly David Burnett and many others continue to incorporate film in their actual journalistic and daily work. I mean, you can still get a roll of film developed and or a sheet of film, as it were, in an hour and make a scan and move it to your client. But just, I guess, the time constraint and some of the other things have definitely put it on a slower burner. And I'm very concerned about that because film offers so many things that digital doesn't. And it's still my preferred whenever I work. Oftentimes my clients demand digital, even though I beg and plead for film. And oftentimes, though, if I beg and plead for film, they allow me to do it. Because there's a look that you can get with film that you just can't get with digital, and especially with the larger formats and some of the lenses and cameras and combinations thereof that allow you to be much more creative with your palette.
Well, let's talk about that. So what are you using here in your workings now with film capture? And we can find out what you're shooting for digital. I mean, are you on the same platform when it comes to 35? And what are you doing? Let's talk about your gear.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been a Nikon guy since I started, so I have all kinds of Nikon equipment as far as 35 and digital are concerned. But moving along to film, I have a plethora of medium and large format cameras that I use all the way from 2.25 up to 8x10. A lot of that equipment is ancient, old, funky equipment that I've assembled by purchases on eBay and at little shops here and there that I run into and find. I have a Wisner 4x5 field camera that I use, of course the venerable Speed Graphic, and a bunch of handheld 4x5 cameras that a guy named Dean Jones in Australia makes. He calls them Razzles. It's an old Polaroid roll film camera that he rips the back off and puts a 4x5 back on there. It's a rangefinder. I call it my Texas Leica, if you will. It's a viewfinder, a rangefinder, and I have five of them with different lenses of focal lengths and focusing points. One of them actually has movements, so I can put it on a tripod and use it with a ground glass. Ultimately, as a journalist, I like to wheel and deal and shoot as I run. I really like large format 4x5, so it's a great extension. And I've shot many of my images on my One of Us project with those. Kodak, all their portrait films, all their C41 portrait color films are amazing now since they came out with their newer grain technologies. And so I can shoot much faster speed films with no grain whatsoever almost compared to the old days of all the films that were available. And put those in those cameras and hand-hold 4x5 exposures in journalistic situations. So that's one of the benefits of all of that I like with those handheld cameras. But now and again, I do like to set my 4x5 up on a tripod and use the ground glass and use some movements and get some other look or feel to a portrait or juju, as I like to call it, and bokeh. For those that don't know what bokeh is, it's a Japanese word that refers to the out-of-focus part of a picture. And there are a lot of photographers out there that like to talk about the bokeh of a lens, because certain lenses give you different looks in that out-of-focus part that makes it dreamy or very sharp in a way. It's just the feel that you can use in your palette, which it's hard to do that with digital capture.
I think a lot of the work that you've been shooting here is this handheld Razzle converted Polaroid 110s and 900s. So let's talk about why you're digging this thing, I think, more than others. Is it because of portability? Is it because of the look? What's your thoughts on using the Razzle?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I certainly never go by the look of something, but the portability is the key factor. I mean, they are almost a shade on the heavy side, but not as heavy as a Speed Graphic, and much more innate to use, like a regular 35 camera, so to speak. So these handheld 4x5s are a great boon for me to be able to react and shoot what I'm seeing as I see it, how I see it, quickly. That's the biggest problem with large format, traditionally, is that you see something developing on a street corner, it looks great. Well, by the time you set up the tripod and grain focus and focus on the ground glass and then slip the back in, the moment's gone. And, of course, like I said, being the disciple of Bresson, I am all about the decisive moment. With that, it allows you to do that and get it on large format, which you just can't even compare the file size, a 4x5 piece of film, compared to even some of the greatest digital sensor megapixels. And there's a depth to film that I still think you get that you don't get with digital capture. Certainly there's a kind of a latitude. The thing I hate about digital is that no matter how perfectly you might make your exposure, you can't take that raw file and send it to the client. You still have to get into the computer and bring in the blacks a little bit and tone down the whites and the highlights. Manipulate the midtones so that it's like you saw it and like you expect it to be, like I used to get with films. Films, they have that latitude where you make your exposure and there's still information in the white, there's good D-max, and there's just, to me, I don't know, it must be because of the physical properties of film. The only way I can attribute it with the layers of crystals or whatever it is in there, but I still think you get much more of a feeling of depth in the images than you do with digital. Digital always seems so much more cut-and-paste looking to me, in a macro sense. To go off on a tangent and to go off on a rant, if you were, about film versus digital, I contend that we're all headed for what I call the digital tragedy, because so much of our history at this point and documentation of our world is invested in files. They're ones and zeros. It's digital, binary, whatever, information. And that information is reliant upon the media that it's on. To the best of my research, there is no media, no hard drive, no DVD, no CD that is technically guaranteed beyond 10 years to not have corruption in the data transfers. So So I'm shackled to this whole world with my digital material being redundant on two different places, plus switching it over to new media every 7 to 10 years to guarantee that it continues to live. Whereas with film, I can have four by five sheets of film in an archival sleeve and put 100 of those in a binder and put them on a shelf. And all I have to do to keep them good is to keep them from getting wet and catching on fire, which you have to do with all your hard drives and CDs anyway.
Yep.
And 2,000 years from now, it should be just fine. And all you have to do to get the information out of it is shine light through it. So whenever it comes to my personal preference and my personal projects and anything that I'm doing, or even if I can talk my clients into it these days, I always prefer to shoot film for all of those reasons and more. But I just feel a little bit better and safer about having it on film than having it on a flash card or on a hard drive or a CD or a DVD. I've already lost two hard drives in the past 6 years. Unfortunately, I had redundant hard drives, but if that was my only resonance of that image, I'd be SOL, and that's not good. So people say it's all cheaper, but I think over the lifespan of an image, as you think of it, by having to move that image from one media to the next over a career or a lifetime and onto your estate, what if you have the picture of the president being shot or something? You have to worry about having that in redundant places. And nothing is safe, even the World Trade Center. All those JFK photos got burned up or destroyed in whatever way that got to it first. But I just think that there's going to be many, many people that have loved ones and family pictures that are lost forever because a CD goes bad or a DVD or a hard drive. And so I think that film is a much more compact and economical, technically, way to have all that. And I don't even know what kind of a file size is attainable with an Imicon scanner on a 4x5 image, but I'm sure it's in the gigabyte range. And even if they came out with a 4x5 digital back that was cheap, even if the digital capture back and everything was $100, can you imagine the file size? You shoot one picture, and let's just say it's a gigabyte. It's all exponential. Then you have to shoot 50 frames in a shoot, a gigabyte a piece, and putting them on hard drives. I don't know. I would just rather shoot it on film. One that you select, then you can scan it and turn it into a digital file later. No big deal.
So let's talk about that. What's your favorite emulsion? What do you like to shoot the best? If you have all the stuff you can try, and of course, I know you used to shoot a lot of Polaroids. I don't know if you're shooting any pack film anymore. I mean, what do you like the best?
Well, I mean, certainly my workhorse film are all the Kodak Portra C41 films, because there's like no grain. They got the 160 and the 400. I just have those. Of course, the venerable Tri-X. I mean, it's been probably my favorite film of all time. I love Tri-X, and I love black and white, actually. I used to use the Polaroid Type 55 films a lot, mostly because it gave me that satisfaction of seeing the image right away, too, and it's black and white. I don't really shoot a whole lot of E6 anymore, but I still love all the Ektachromes and all those Kodak films. But for me, 90% of the time, it's just the portrait films, both in 2.25 and then 4x5. And in 35, it's almost always Tri-X. Sometimes the T-Max, which is great. It's so sharp, it's almost too sharp compared to the Tri-X. There's something, I don't know, there's a je ne sais quoi, a juju about Tri-X that I love. And I don't think there's any photographer that can technically describe what it is about Tri-X, even though there are technically better grain quality films out there like the T-Max stuff. But there's something about Tri-X, and maybe it's because that's what you cut your teeth on. I think we all started out with rolls of Tri-X, so those are my favorite films to use.
So if you can only grab one camera and one kind of film, what would you grab?
Boy, if I had to have one camera, it'd probably be my Leica M6 that I've had forever. It's like an appendage of my body. It's always on me. And a roll of Tri-X. It's light. It's small. It's unbelievably sharp. You can handhold that thing at 1/4 of a second. And then the Tri-X augments all of those aspects. And I can make pictures. I love black and white most. It'd be a toss-up between the Tri-X and maybe some 400 Portra or something. But ultimately, I believe in black and white first because it's so content-oriented. There are a lot of photographers that make a living out of color. And to me, 90% of the time, I find color to be distracting from the point of my image rather than helping it. Most of the time, if you have a great image in color, it would be just as great in black and white. That's kind of, if not better, in a lot of ways, I think. But it depends on the kind of photography you're doing. If you're going on the visual sense, but I'm usually more on the documentation and feeling or communication, the context of the image, what the items are in the subject matter is in the image rather than the colors within them. And I would love to have a 4x5 camera as my one camera, I think. But for complete ease of use and in any condition, it's hard to beat an M6 and some Tri-X. And, of course, I really do need to get into getting the Leica digital, but I'm still kind of an old school and pretty stubborn and hard-headed guy when it comes to going there yet. But it's mostly because of the whole digital thing. I know digital is the way. And, of course, the Leica optics are bar none, no matter which way you slice it, which is one of the reasons why everyone likes those great contrast and beautifully sharp in all ways. And technically, a rangefinder is a much more precise way to focus than even with your eye through an SLR. When you have a precision instrument like an M6, the rangefinder in that thing, it's pretty amazing. You focus on the eyeball, and the eyeball sharp, and the eyelashes out sometimes, which can add to the whole juju of your image if that's where you want to put your emphasis, as I like to say. That's a great way to do it, is with shallow depth of field. And the other thing that's great about a small camera like that, with the bigger cameras, it draws attention to you. And as a journalist, I feel compelled to be a fly on the wall rather than to be an attention getter. When people see those Leicas, they don't think anything of you. You just look like a shutter bug. But when you got a big F5 or a D3 hanging off your shoulder with a big old lens on there, they're like, hey, what channel am I going to be on tonight?
Right.
Channel 2, check it out, 10 o'clock. Yeah, you'll be on. They don't even know that it's not still photography. They think you're with the TV station. So that's one of the reasons that I really, really like old cameras like those Razzles. Initially, people, they look at it and they go, what the heck is that? And you do get a little of attention with a bigger camera because it's so big. But then they just think you're just some freak with some old equipment. But when you have that latest, greatest equipment, it draws way too much attention. Certainly when I was on my assignment this past week, it was kind of annoying because people do pay attention to you when you have the big, new, latest, greatest, expensive equipment. I'd rather have a pinhole camera sometimes.
Exactly. Chris, you have a couple of really great projects here, and I think the one that people have seen a lot recently, Kodak did a great video on one of their podcasts about your project. All this great work you've been doing here in New Orleans with Katrina. It looks like all this has been shot on 4x5 film. This is just great stuff.
There are a handful of digital images in there, I will admit. Certainly, the whole thing started when I was on assignment for Time. And drove storm in my truck and got down there a few hours after it passed through and spent 3 weeks down there. And that was all digital capture by necessity. And then a cover story that I did for Time about 3 months after that. And I was so profoundly affected by what I experienced and saw and all of that that my heart really went out for the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And I felt obligated, almost completely committed to documenting this whole issue. Because to me, Katrina, it's the Dust Bowl of the 21st century. It's a natural cataclysmic event and unnatural in the case of New Orleans in some cases. But either way, the devastation occurred and so much of the press covered it, but they didn't really document it. Because once the event was over, everyone seemed to kind of go home and move along to the next story. But to me, the event was certainly something to cover. But the real story is all these hundreds of thousands of people having to get their lives back. And that's a long and slow process, and it still isn't good down there. Still. So to any of you who are listening to this program, I beg and urge you to see it with your own two eyes. There's no still image or video that captures the feeling of immense sorrow and destruction as it is to just be down there. Go into New Orleans East today, and you'll get tears in your eyes. There are trees growing up through cracks in the middle of the street. They're ghost towns. People are not back in their homes still. Sure, Canal Street and the French Quarter, which didn't get affected terribly by all of that, because it's much higher ground anyway, are back online and as usual. But so much of New Orleans is completely forgotten about. And there are myriad reasons why people cannot get back into their homes. So many that you can't point a finger at any one thing, and it's often combinations of two or three of them between government assistance, their insurance, their banks, their mortgages, their lives, their jobs, so much of it. And it's all exacerbated by this current economy has just made it even worse, and it's still bad down there. And so I encourage anyone who can to go down and see it and or help in some way. I know that there are a lot of organizations and religious groups of all kinds that are continuing to go down there every week, making dents, and those small dents have definitely brought a lot of people back. And a lot of the success stories that I've run into, people that are back into their homes, are usually not through government assistance. And everything from local, state, to federal has been quite inadequate, in my opinion, and certainly to all of those that are still down there and languishing. And families have been all spread apart, and they're still in all parts of the country trying to make a living and trying to get back home. So I definitely hope that if you can, go down there and see it, and it will change your attitude about it. It's not fixed. That's my whole point, really. So yes, I made it a point, and I kind of gave myself a self-assignment because the news magazines really don't have the budget. As one editor put it, when I wanted to go back to the first Mardi Gras, and I asked what they were going to work on, and were they interested if I was going to be down there, and they're like, oh, we're so over that story. So at that point, I took out a home equity loan, and Kodak was very, very gracious to help me out in many ways with film and processing and a little bit of grant money here and there. I've spent an enormous amount of time going down there every 3 to 6 months documenting and recording the stories of the people and photographing them, making portraits, which to me, after being down there, all the destruction pictures I thought really actually kind of numbed people or separated them from the event. And although they're necessary, I didn't think that they really drove it home nearly to the heart, nearly as well as actually seeing somebody and hearing their story. And so I kind of gave myself a self-assignment and thought of myself as an FSA photographer, like all the greats, Rothstein and Lang, and going out and documenting this whole plight and issue over a period of time. And it's been a very rewarding experience because I've met so many wonderful people. I have so many surrogate mothers and fathers and families all in the Gulf Coast and New Orleans. Wonderful people that I've met that have been defiant and very noble about their plight. And that's very hard sometimes for me to shoot them when I know what they're going through. But yet they still have somewhat of a smile on their face, and I think that that's just amazing. So Kodak, once again, came to the plate, offered to pay for the actual printing cost of this self-published book called One of Us, which you can find on my website at www.chrisusher.com. In the news section, there's a link there where you can buy this book for $40. And I think there's some shipping and handling involved with that also. But 100% of that $40, I don't get a penny. That's my way of helping out Katrina, the Gulf Coast, and New Orleans. I just decided I couldn't feel right making any money from other people's misery. I don't think I would sleep well at night doing that. But when you go to buy it, there's a prompt so that the money is divided between two organizations that were and still are making a contribution down there and helping as much as they can with the plight of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And that is the Southern Animal Foundation, which is the animal side, because I think animals were very forgotten about in that event. And that's actually the one good thing that's come out of it, is that there has been legislation that came out of Congress that makes it possible for people to, in the event of another Katrina, that they can bring their pets, which are like family members to most of us, I think, when you do have a pet, and are allowed to bring their pet with them when they evacuate or are rescued. And that was a big problem that I ran into talking to a lot of people down there. And the other recipient is the Gulf Coast Fund, which is busy helping rebuilding people's lives. So if you're a misanthrope and you hate people, you can have all your $40 go to the animals. You can have all your $40 go to the people, or it can be an even split of 50-50. So that's the story with that, my project and that book. And I continue to keep in touch with these people, and I will continue to do this project. Maybe not quite as fervorous a scope now that the book is out, but I will continue. And I just came back from New Orleans, actually. I just spent a week down there and just got back yesterday.
So this project continues. The book's out, but you're still shooting. You're still going down there.
Yes, I've already committed to donating all my recordings and film, actually, to the Louisiana State Museum and the Mississippi Historical Society, Mississippi State Museum there, too. So depending on where the material came from. Because to me, I felt more a documentarian and somebody that just wanted to record this for history than it was certainly an artistic thing or a journalistic thing or anything. I just felt it was almost a duty for me to record this because I really didn't see anyone else necessarily doing that. And I definitely didn't want to be a carpetbagger just making pictures to sell books and prints or something like some people. So that's been my MO on this whole project from day one, pretty much.
No, I think it's a great project. The photography is phenomenal. It's just cool to see that you're helping to try to get these people's stories out, and it is terrible the way they were treated by the U.S. government and everybody else. They were pretty much left for dead.
Well, absolutely. There's all this crying about there's not enough money or whatever, but since then, we've certainly found trillions for Wall Street, so I don't know what's up.
Well, it's not cool. It's not fashionable, so if it was fashionable, they would have went through and fixed all the stuff that was broken and brought the town back to its former stature. Like you said, it's like the other PR people told you. Oh, we're done with that story.
Yes, it's not going to sell magazines, so we're not interested. Yeah, that's pretty much was my take on that, too. So someone had to do it, and I felt good doing it, and I enjoyed doing it. I think I mentioned it in my foreword in the book. I really will stick to it like a dog with a bone until Katrina is just a memory and there really aren't any more scars on the landscape to remind us of that event. It continues, and my biggest thing, if there's anything you remember from me talking about this project, aside from going to get that book and having that money get to the ground and continue to help people, is that it is still bad down there. I think that once you get 300 miles away from New Orleans, it's pretty much forgotten about. But they haven't forgotten down there, and they're still not that happy. Even the people that are back in their homes, because their neighbors aren't there, and their best friends, and many of their family members are still scattered about the country. Down there, in the South, in particular in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast there, the nuclear family is still a very, very major and prevalent way of life. Oftentimes, the families, brothers, sisters, grandma, grandpa, aunts and uncles all live within a few blocks of each other. And they all spend time together a lot and making up some good food, some boudin or something, enjoying hanging out. And grandma looks after the kids while they go to work or whatever. And then Wednesday nights they spend at Granny's house, and Thursday night always over at Uncle Louie's place down the street, and everyone hangs out. And now that nuclear family unit has just been scattered around. It makes them sad. So that some people that are back in their homes, they don't have their best friends and neighbors that used to be around to watch after their house when they're out. That whole sense of community has really been torn up down there. Really been torn up.
Wow. So, Chris, where do we get more information on your stuff? We want to have you back in the program talking about your wet plate photography you're up to and all this other stuff. But for now, where do people find out more information about what you're doing, the projects, the books, all the things that you're doing, buddy?
Well, pretty much you can find me at chrisusher.com. I'm just now working on putting a bunch of new material up there as soon as I can catch my breath from what I am doing. There's always Google. There are all kinds of articles and things that I've done in the past and stuff with that that you can find just with a simple Google. And there's a podcast on Kodak, kodak.com. It's a really long URL to finally get there, but it's there. Pretty much that's it.
Well, I do appreciate you joining us today, and we definitely want to talk some more because this is really interesting about doing this handheld 4x5. We didn't get a chance to talk about the development and the rest of your workflow, and I definitely want to talk later about your wet plate photography that I think you're getting into that is just really cool.
It's a whole lot of fun, man, and I highly recommend it. There's something that's really satisfying because it's kind of like everything all in one. And sooner or later, it may not be viable for all these people to make film, and we may have to make our own.
Right. It's very true, and I think this is great work, Chris, and it's just great to see you shooting film and doing all this great analog photography, just being so enthusiastic about it. I think it's great for the whole community of photographers to see you're doing this stuff, and it just helps us keep film alive and people practicing the analog process. This is just great work, buddy.
Well, thanks, man, and as just a quick little pickup on that thought, I really, truly believe that the honeymoon with digital has been over, and there is a resurgence of analog photographers coming up. I teach off and on. Last fall, I taught a semester at Corcoran School of Art. I had students that they started out on digital. They had never really done film, and they have to do film. But once they discovered film, it was like a whole new world to them, and the excitement in their eyes. And I get a lot of emails out of the blue from people out there in internet land that were saying, oh, I've always shot digital, but man, now I'm finding film, and this is awesome. So I think that it's almost like the antithetical. It's like the resurgence when people are rediscovering film again and what you can do with it. Like I say, there's all kinds of reasons you'd use different films, different lenses, even digital for different paints in your pot and on your palette. Film is certainly one that I hope never goes away. I think that it certainly can't hurt for us all to go out and buy film and use it, then they'll keep making it. But ultimately, it's the accountants that run the show at any company. If they're not selling enough film, they'll quit making it. So let's hope that they keep making it.
Yep, that's it. The only way to make them keep making it is to go spend money. Buy film. If you shoot film, they'll
film
keep making
and use it.
It.
That's the thing. It's like so many people think that digital is cheaper because you just get that flash card and you can shoot it over and over and over and over. But ultimately, film, I think it really is cheaper. I think if some good student out there doing a master's thesis should actually calculate out to the nth degree to an average age of 76, shooting film today and putting it in a notebook and or keeping digital going and what the costs are of the digital equipment and the processing and the film and upkeep, I contend that it will come out much cheaper to shoot film.
Yep. So, Chris, really appreciate it, buddy. We're going to look forward to talking to you here very shortly to talk about this wet plate and maybe some of the stuff on how you're souping your 4x5 and what else you're up to. But for today's stuff, it's just great to talk to you, to see your work, to hear your enthusiasm about film and how people can look up with what you're doing. And this is great stuff you're doing, buddy.
Well, thanks a lot, Scott. And it's a pleasure to be on your show. And anytime, I'd love to talk about anything, the wet plate included.
Well, there you go. Chris Usher, beautiful work, unbelievable 4x5 handheld photography, all the stuff he's been doing to help out the victims of Katrina, the book, just a lot of great work that Chris has been doing. Beautiful photography, and of course, Analog Capture rocks. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.